Good afternoon. I think we'll get started. I'm Wayne Clark, and I'm the director of Monterey County Behavioral Health Services and immediate past president of the California Mental Health Service Authority, which is a joint powers authority established in California with 51 different counties joining together on this important prevention and mental health promotion campaign. I have no personal financial relationships or anything, so I don't need to discuss that. What we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about how we got here, what we did in order to get to the place with all of the campaign materials and that we have, and then have some question and answer. I do want to mention that we have a number of these booklets and pamphlets that are available. They're on a chair over there, and you can just take one on the way out, or if you want one currently, just grab them from Ann. One of the benefits of this large campaign is we have a lot of material that we want to distribute, and we also have it in many different languages and think it can be used in various jurisdictions throughout the country. We've also had some inquiries internationally, so if you want the material or want access to it, please don't hesitate. The 1998, when the Surgeon General released the very important report on mental health, it started some inquiries in California with some of our legislators. One of those was a fellow named Daryl Steinberg, who was very much of an advocate for mental health services in California, and he proposed in 2003 a state initiative to tax those persons that made over $1 million in adjusted gross income, 1% of their income annually. This produces somewhere between $700 million and $1.5 billion a year for mental health services. As part of his efforts, we initiated a stakeholder planning process to look at what do we want to do in the area of prevention in and above the passage of that initiative of Prop 63. And so we created three stakeholder processes. The stakeholder processes looked at suicide prevention, stigma reduction, and student mental health. And those three different statewide initiatives, 500 or more people were involved statewide, then produced a plan. And that plan was then provided to the Oversight and Accountability Commission of the Mental Health Service Act. And we in Cal Mesa formed our association to implement that plan. And we did that in 2009, and we've been working on it for the last 5 to 6 years. And we have quite an extensive set of programs, and we're going to go over those today with some of our illustrious staff here that are with us. We joined the Joint Powers Authority. An implementation plan was developed. We looked at the three initiatives composed of stigma, suicide, and student, and how to get synergy across those. And we applied a public health approach to this as part of the planning efforts. Let me go back. Sorry about that. This seems to be automatic. And the public health approach, and I think some of you have been in some of the other sessions about looking at mental health promotion and mental health challenge prevention is a different way of looking at things rather than just early intervention or just treatment, but it's instead looking at it for where you change the environment, you look at policies, practices, you engage communities by implementing social marketing strategies, and you impact the individual by boosting supportive services. And that comprehensive approach is what we've employed. We have about $110 million in order to do that over the last 4 or 5 years. We also wanted to see if we could assure that we could evaluate its effects. And so we, part of our planning was to send an RFP out for researchers in the social sciences. We had several research agencies, about a dozen of them. We reviewed those. University of California's, all the different campuses applied. We had several Beltway Bandits applying as well. And we also had the RAND Corporation, and they stood very much above the others as far as a comprehensive ability to look at the prevention. Because we wanted to look at the structure. What did we put together? What are the components of this? What are the essential parts, whether it's needs assessments or educational resource or marketing campaigns? What intervention activities are delivered and to whom? So we wanted to be able to measure that to see what kind of, we'll call it reach, how far we were able to see and have people see the different components of the campaign. We wanted to then look at the short-term outcomes, changes in attitudes and knowledge and behaviors of our students, of our persons that we were looking at to try to influence in the community. And then eventually we want to look at the key outcomes, whether we can reduce suicide, reduce discrimination, change social isolation, and look at student failure in our communities. And so RAND has been involved in that. A number of baseline studies have been done, and there's some discussion we'll have a little bit later about some of the research that's been accomplished so far, and also some very excellent literature reviews that were initially initiated looking at worldwide prevention and mental health promotion campaigns. Key resources created through PI niches and the impact. Is this now to you?
This is me.
Yes. Okay, I just wanted to introduce that. First, let me introduce now Stephanie Welch. Stephanie is a senior program manager of the California Mental Health Service Authority. Stephanie helps manage California's efforts to prevent suicide, improve student mental health, and reduce stigma and discrimination. She has 14 years of experience in mental health policy, programming, and advocacy, and holds an MSW from the University of California and a BA in sociology from the University of California, Davis. Her advocacy is recognized by the CSA Voice Award. I've known Stephanie for probably about 9 or 10 years. She was also there when the Surgeon General's report was released. She was there when that Mental Health Service Act was passed, and she's been there for us now for the last several years in implementing the Mental Health CalMESA's programs for mental health promotion. Stephanie.
Thanks, Wayne. Hi, everybody. It's so nice to see so many of you after lunch. I know I had to. It's really hard to find that in a reasonable amount of time and get to your next workshop. So I really appreciate everybody being here. So today we're going to really want to have an opportunity to share with you tools and resources that we hope that you can use in your communities. We have been very lucky in California to be blessed with a funding source that allows us to do mental health prevention and mental health promotion. It's something that we feel lucky to be able to do, but also we want to share those tools and resources because we know in other states or even at the national level, having the ability and resources to actually commit to mental health prevention or mental health promotion is not something that's as readily accessible. And we created these tools and resources with the best resources and research in mind, and also with the intent that we can provide them to you and you can utilize them, test them, adapt them to your local community. So that's really one of our main goals today. Oversee our stigma and discrimination reduction programs. And for those of you who maybe aren't as familiar with the issue of stigma, just really quickly, stigma is something that we feel is at the core of everything we try to do in the work that we do. We really want to eradicate it. And it's because we know that there are lots of impacts from stigma. One is that it reduces help-seeking behavior, reduces, obviously, service utilization and a willingness or a willingness to want to participate in services. It also adversely affects one's self-perceptions, how they feel about themselves, and that, of course, is going to impact how they are benefiting from services. Another issue that's really important to us are some of the social impacts from stigma. So stigma causes social exclusion. It causes limited opportunities. So it may limit their ability to receive family support or support from their peers. It reduces your healthcare access. It can create obstacles to equal employment, housing, and school opportunities, and it may result in negative interactions with the criminal justice system. So I guess what I'm trying to say is when we get up here and talk about eradicating stigma, it really is about approaching our communities and trying to make them empowered to make sure that someone who is experiencing a mental health condition or taking care of someone who's experiencing a mental health condition can have as many equal opportunities as anyone else who's experiencing maybe another health challenge. Here in this particular picture, the only way to really truthfully or effectively, from what we know in the research, eradicate stigma is really to have quite a significant commitment to three different areas of activity. So self-stigma kind of speaks to tackling issues at the individual level, so making sure that we are providing practices that really support somebody in their wellness and recovery and their resilience. Public stigma is really addressing stigma at the community level. That would be through social marketing, training, education, some of those strategies that we use in a public health approach. And systemic stigma is tackled through policy change, really looking at our laws, the way that we practice the health care that we have, and making sure that it is not either intentionally or unintentionally reinforcing stigma. So why is it important? I think that, as Wayne alluded to, I've been slightly obsessed with this issue for the last 15 years, and I can say that I do believe that we are making progress, and I think these numbers represent some progress, but also where we have focused our efforts because there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So the good news is that 73% of the people that we surveyed, this is our statewide and California general population survey that we did with about 2,000 people, random digit dialed, and we did some oversampling for some of our in-language subpopulations as well. But what we generally found is that here we have 73% of Californians really saying that people who have mental illness are experiencing high levels of prejudice and discrimination. So there was a recognition that this is a problem that we have. At the same time, the next two facts that you have there, or findings, really shows that there continues to be an unwillingness to improve on measures of social distance. So what that means basically is we still have a significant amount of the population, more than a quarter in both cases, if not three quarters, that are really unwilling to move next door to someone if they know that they have a mental illness. And this one, which I thought was particularly concerning, really being unwilling to work closely with someone on a job. So those deep ingrained misconceptions that someone who's experiencing a mental illness is not as productive, maybe they're not as intelligent, maybe they're not as reliable, and these are issues that we really miss, that we really want to correct. And then the last one is really about disclosure, and this really identifies for us that close to half of people who are experiencing a mental illness still do not want to disclose or share that they have a mental health problem. And that speaks volumes, because if you can't share that you're going through a challenge, then you can't receive support from your community. And really what we're in the business of doing, as you guys all know, because I come from mental health and many of you are probably from public health, we really need to empower our communities to support their fellow community members. And if you're not able to go to a coworker, you're not able to go to a neighbor and talk about what your challenge is, how can we use our communities to keep people healthy? Okay, so today, now that we know why we care so much about eradicating stigma and it's an important part of what we do, today we're going to talk a little bit about how we're doing it. And I want to encourage all of you, when we're done here and my other colleagues talk about some of the other things that we do, to please come up to our table, look at some of the items that we have, and also visit us at the mental health section booth, where anything that we can't have you walk away with today because your hands are full, you can get more copies of later on as the week progresses. So things that we do in our stigma and discrimination reduction program is that we have created a social marketing various different social marketing strategies. They're really about empowering communities, and they are intended to change public perceptions across diverse lifespans. And we also support the integration of mental health and primary care, which is talked about quite a bit at this conference. So we know that there are many populations, particularly our racial, ethnically, and culturally diverse populations, that feel more comfortable receiving their mental health services in a primary care setting and through that relationship they have with their primary care doctor. We also want to create and disseminate best practices for stigma reduction. That's something that we're building an evidence base around, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. We also wanted to address the impact of media portrayals of mental illness. Unfortunately, we still live in a culture of which, while we've gotten tremendously better in the last 10 years, one of the statistics that I skipped over on the last slide talks about the fact that there is still a belief, at least amongst Californians in our survey, that 50% of people thought that if you had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, that was equivalent to being violent, where if you had depression or PTSD, only about 20% of the population thought that those conditions were associated with violence. So again, there's a lot of work to do, and unfortunately, a lot of it is through our media makers and making sure that they accurately report about mental health issues. Okay, so we also feel strongly about fostering networks and collaborations. As you all know, in public health, unless we empower the people at the ground level, at the community level that are doing this work, we're not going to successfully change attitudes and change behaviors. And that gets to the last one. It's really supporting our community members with training. Okay, so I am going to start first with our social marketing campaign. This is a nice color, but it is not my favorite color. I seem to be wearing it a lot, but does anyone in the audience know why I'm wearing lime green? Yes, well, yes, absolutely. And we're trying, so what this young lady said is that lime green is the color that's trying to eradicate stigma. I think one of the ways that we're really framing what is lime green, and it wasn't something that we came up with in California, I believe it was actually Massachusetts where we heard about it, is that we believe it's an emerging national color for mental health awareness. And I bring this up because in my time, I started out in this work where we were really talking about trying to quote unquote brand mental health as a brain disorder, and we thought that the strategy of equating mental health almost solely as a brain disorder would help us at parity at getting resources with people who had other serious medical conditions. And unfortunately, that strategy did not work, particularly in the public perception. That's for another, I'm sure there's probably another session here where you could learn more about what we learned from those investments we made in the 90s that were not quite as successful. So what the lime green color is to represent is really about mental health awareness, and it is lime green, at least according to some of the things that we've read, because it's a really vibrant color and it's about strength and resilience. It's a warm and happy color. And we really want those to be the messages and the principles behind what we do with mental health awareness. Mental health does not have to be something that's dark and scary to talk about. It's something that people, they should embrace their mental health as they do their physical health, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. So we kind of learned about this lime green stuff a few years ago and wanted to go full force ahead in promoting it as a way, as a state of 38 million people, to bring our state together under one umbrella to have a cause and to champion. And so that is what we've been able to do with the lime green. It also has, and what we've been promoting, is this lime green ribbon. Many of you received that ribbon in your packets. And one of the things that's a beauty about ribbons in general, whether it's a pink ribbon or a yellow ribbon, is it allows the person who's wearing the ribbon to engage with whoever asks about the ribbon on the issue that they care passionately about. And in the mental health community, one of the reasons why we like the lime green ribbon is that each person who is wearing it has their own story and their reason why they care about mental health awareness. They could be somebody who is a consumer or they've lived through a mental health issue. They could be supporting or taking care of someone with a mental health issue. They could care about the policy issues that keep people with mental health challenges with less opportunities in life, and they get that opportunity wearing the ribbon to share those messages with whoever asks about it, whether it's the TSA agent, who I say that that's the number one person that asked me about why am I wearing this green ribbon, to your hairdresser. And what we know about reducing stigma is that it is that local, continuous contact that peers have, and I don't mean peers as in, you know, people with lived experience. I mean you as a teacher talking to your fellow teachers, you as a member of a congregation talking to fellow members of your congregation. They listen to you, and so when they ask you about the green ribbon and you honestly reply with why it's meaningful to you, you have the ability, far more than me, to impact change. And while I'm going to move on, I do want to challenge all of you to take your green ribbon with you, read a little bit more about it, and think about why do you wear it, and what would you say if someone asked you about that green ribbon? So some of the tools and resources that we have include a lot of digital media. We do focus the majority of our programming on young people, which you'll see when you hear a little bit from my colleagues about the work that they do. And it's just an effective way to reach people with a powerful message in a short period of time. We have 41 different vignettes. I encourage you to go to our website, which is www.eachmindmatters.org. You can watch all of those 41 vignettes. They're between 1 minute and 7 minutes in multiple different languages. We also developed a documentary, which is a little bit longer and can work for community educational activities. And as I mentioned before, we're really about empowering communities. And so what we've done in California, we're huge, and we know that we can't be effective without pushing our resources and building the capacity of our communities. So we use a variety of different programs. These are two of them, to empower people at the local level to receive some training. They get our tools and resources, and then they go out to their networks, whether they're congregations, which is very popular, veterans organizations, schools, and start talking about mental health. And you know, we've been able to push out close to $700,000 so far into communities, and we also work with and empower and identify groups that can speak to their fellow groups, right? So we have given about 18 different grants to different Native American tribes. We've reached a variety of different people who speak Spanish, Lao, and again, it's really about people in the community talking to their peers. So we're excited. We're brand new. Each Mind Matters has been around for about 2 years, but we're making slow and steady progress. We do not buy media. We do not buy big billboards. I learned early on I'm a social worker, not a social marketing person, but social marketing is really about empowering communities to do that work. And I thought actually it really was buying TV ads. But that's not what we do, so far, slow and steady wins the race, and we're doing fairly well. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit about one of our sub-programs under our Each Mind Matter banner of programs in California. That's our Reach Out Here program, and it is for transition-age youth. How am I doing on time? 3 minutes. Okay. Reach Out Here is really about targeting 14 to 24-year-olds, and it might be of interest to you guys out there. We do have a what we call a peer-moderated online chat forum, and actually, you see that number down there that says about 350,000 folks from California have been visiting the site. We actually have far more people from outside of California that visit Reach Out and use our forums, that's fine. So please think about it as a resource. It's available in English and in Spanish. We currently have a two-way texting program. We're really struggling, actually, to find resources to continue to fund that program. But it has. We are studying it and trying to better understand its sustainability. Well, we have learned about Reach Out. The good news is that it is working. The purpose of Reach Out is really to have peers go to the website. They may have questions about their own mental health challenges or how to help a friend, and they definitely feel that the website empowers them to know how to help a friend or how to help themselves. We also know, and this doesn't probably surprise anyone in the audience, that more females are using the website, are engaged in the conversation on the forums, and we are exploring other ways to engage young men and young boys. They're not young, they're younger. Lastly, we do have a variety of different tools that we've created specifically for cultural communities. Really want to encourage you guys to go to the Each Mind Matters website. You can learn more about each of these programs. Sanamente is our Spanish language campaign. We have a whole photo novella series. We have mentally friendly communities. That's targeting our African American communities, and that's a faith-based curriculum, or a curriculum for faith leaders. Our Native Community Cares, I already spoke about that. We have an LGBTQ partnership with Reach Out, and we also have developed resources in Hmong, Cambodian, Lao, actually, as well, for our API communities. Oh, I thought it was done. Okay, well, I need to be done. You guys have these slides, and I am going to go really quickly through them, so I apologize, but I also will be at the booth on Wednesday, the mental health section booth, so you can come by and ask me any questions. But we believe in making sure that we're supporting the integration of mental health and primary care, so we do have a toolkit that we've developed that really targets primary care providers. It's all online. There's a series of webinars. And the thing I'm most excited about it, which is a new addition that we've provided that's specific to kind of our goals around stigma reduction, which is our peer support toolkit. And that is really supporting peer providers, people with lived experience, to work as care navigators in the primary care setting. Wellness Works, as I mentioned before, we want to help people be successful in staying employed even if they're having a mental health challenge, and that's what this program is all about. So far, it's been fairly successful in our initial data collection in making sure that employers have better skills in supporting their employees to disclose and to continue to stay employed during the experience of a mental health challenges. Please visit this particular website. I know it's a long website, but this is one of our program partners, and it really might be of interest to folks in here who like to do a lot of research. This is really identifying effective models and tools that have some evidence base to reduce stigma for different populations. So say you want to find out what works for law enforcement, what works for primary care, you can go to this registry. We have 120 different programs in there that have evidence base. But we also have a component of that registry that is looking at what are some new strategies coming up, particularly from diverse communities, and putting those promising practices and making them available. Lastly, here are just some of the programs that we fund in order to do our community gatekeeper training. Mental Health First Aid, it's kind of all the buzz right now. NAMI, a family member organization. We also work with Disability Rights California, which does all sorts of training to empower consumers and family members, even parents, to understand what their rights are if they do have a mental health disability, how to utilize the system. All these resources are available to you online, fact sheets in multiple languages that might be useful for the work that you do. And our Ending the Silence program is a high school program that's administered by our NAMI chapters. Okay. All right. That is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. As you can see, the stigma reduction is part of the heart of our efforts, but it is also intimately tied to our suicide prevention and student mental health initiatives. Teresa Lee is a program manager for the California Mental Health Service Authority, is lead staff of statewide suicide prevention efforts. Previously, she provided training and technical assistance to California's counties at California's Office of Suicide Prevention and continued to provide technical assistance, particularly around social marketing on on California's statewide suicide prevention social marketing campaign. She earned her master's degree in public health with an emphasis in health and social behavior, and she's part of putting these this presentation together, so I have a special thanks for her for helping putting all these slides together for us.
Hi, everyone. Apologies if I sound a little weird. I think I'm kind of coming down with something. But I did want to talk today about California Suicide Prevention Initiative that I kind of oversee a lot of the statewide work for. So I wanted to give a quick kind of initiative overview, kind of like what Stephanie did with the SDR initiative. We're not going to be talking about every single one of these things today, but I wanted to give you kind of a sense as to what we've been trying to do for the past couple of years, specifically in suicide prevention for California. One of the things that we did was created regional networks, which basically brought together people who had never really talked about suicide prevention before throughout the state to talk about what suicide prevention is, get some resources, get some kind of connections to other folks in their community. And two things that they did was actually they each created regional best practices, so really took a look at what each of the five regions in California needed. And obviously we have a very diverse state, so they all kind of came up with different needs and therefore different best practices and submitted them to a national best practices registry through the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. Another thing that these regional networks did was create a common data collection sources specifically for crisis centers. In California we have about 13 or 14 of them, so we can talk about that a little bit more. The second thing that we also did, similar to the SDR initiative, was do gatekeeper trainings. And we did primarily assist and safe talk trainings. Are you guys familiar with those types of trainings? Okay. All right. If you have any questions about those, feel free to let me know. But basically, this was our effort in engaging the community so that they know how to recognize the warning signs of suicide and really have an effective and safe conversation with someone who is at risk for suicide. We developed the social marketing campaign, which is called Know the Signs, to inform Californians on how to identify suicide risk and refer to help. And again, this is different from a lot of other suicide prevention campaigns that are out there because we are focusing on helpers, not the individual who is at risk for suicide themselves. And then finally, we enhanced the services of crisis centers, so we increased their capacity. We helped them with increasing their language offerings, so we have many hotlines now that provide 24/7 Spanish, Korean, and Vietnamese. Maybe not all 24/7, but the services are there. Many of them have employed new technologies, so expanding outside of hotline services, going into chat, going into text, and we'll be talking about a mobile app that we developed. And then we also helped improve the policies, systems, and data collections across these crisis centers so that they are more cohesive and that they really represent kind of all together, all their data together really gives us a good representation of who in California is reaching out for help. So that's our big initiative overview, and now I just wanted to drill down into the three primary things that might be very interesting for you guys no matter where you are in the country. This is the social marketing campaigns, again, to reach the helpers of individuals who are at risk for suicide, our suicide prevention mobile app, which is called My3, and then that framework for standardized data collection across crisis centers. In California, we have 13 to 15 crisis centers 24/7 that operate throughout the state. Some of the smaller states might have maybe one or two, but cohesive data collection really is an important thing for us to have at our fingertips so that we really understand who's calling and who needs help. So focusing on the social marketing campaign, which is again the Know the Signs campaign, we wanted to, before we launched into any campaign, we wanted to know what direction should this campaign take. So before we launched the campaign, we did in 2011-2012, we did a statewide survey, and we found that Californians knew of at least one source of assistance, like a crisis line or some kind of a service that they could tap into, and or one warning sign for suicide, or had personal experience with suicide. These guys were significantly more confident in their ability to discuss suicide with a person who was at risk. So we really wanted to capitalize on that, and we created the Know the Signs campaign, which is has three directives. It's to know the signs of suicide, the warning signs of suicide, find the words on how to talk about suicide with someone, that you do not have to kind of keep it in the shadows. You can actually have a conversation. It's actually helpful if you ask someone if they are suicidal. And then finally, what are your local resources in your county, throughout the state and nationally, that you can tap into? So again, raising awareness of warning signs, raising awareness that there are actions to take to help someone, and there are other resources that can help you along your path of helping someone else. We started off with some kind of generic materials. Pain isn't always obvious is one of our taglines, but we did create some materials that were focused on the primary high-risk groups in California, and very similar high-risk groups across the country, middle-aged men, white men specifically, as well as young Latinas. So we started off with those. And as the campaign progressed, we created culturally adapted materials. And these are kind of fresh off the press, so you guys should be very lucky to see them. I have a couple of examples here. These are materials for helpers of African American youth, API or Asian Pacific Islander youth, and then we also created materials that reach a variety of different API languages, including Chinese, Khmer, Lao, Korean, Vietnamese, and I think I might be missing two of them or something, but clearly California has a very diverse audience, and so we really wanted to make sure that we were reaching those folks as well. Just a couple of impact information, just because the campaign has been going on for so long, we do have some data on how it's been effective. So in terms of its reach, we have, to our English website, we've had about 531,000 unique visits, which are actual new people coming to the site. And I forgot to mention this, but we did launch the campaign in early 2012, and it's still going on. We have fewer unique visits going to the Spanish website, but still a significant amount. This was some data that was collected from the RAND Corporation, again, the organization that's doing our statewide evaluation of all our PEI programs. They found that we are hitting many of the key kind of demographics in California, although, we're hitting mostly white folks because that is really a high-risk population there. We wanted to kind of capture all the helpers around those middle-aged white men, as well as Hispanic Americans. But we do still have a little bit more work in reaching API communities and African-American communities. RAND also did a statewide survey not too long ago that found, of their kind of survey population, 35% of Californians had heard about the Know the Signs campaign. But most importantly, those individuals who had heard about the campaign had higher overall confidence to talk to someone who was at risk for suicide, and generally had overall more knowledge about suicide prevention compared to those individuals who weren't exposed. So this was exactly what we wanted to see happen. So really, it's just a matter of increasing the exposure. And I think we're going to hold questions to the end, if that's okay?
Yeah.
Thanks. hold it. just a few other details about the impact. RAND convened an expert messaging panel. For those of you who aren't familiar with suicide prevention, messaging is really important because we don't want to spread contagion around suicide. We don't want to kind of further the myths around suicide. We don't want people who are at risk for suicide to read details about someone else's death and therefore increase their own risk for completing a suicide. So messaging is incredibly important. This expert messaging panel found that the campaign followed safe and effective messaging guidelines that follow these established guidelines that are nationally established. So again, just a couple of things: didn't glorify or romanticize suicide, didn't communicate myths, avoid depiction of suicide acts or means, and really overall just tried to have a hopeful and action-oriented approach to how to help someone who is having thoughts of suicide. So the next thing I wanted to move on to was our suicide prevention mobile app. We have a couple cards here. This is a national resource now. It was originally developed actually as the seed idea came from a suicide intervention work group down in Santa Clara County, otherwise known as Silicon Valley, of suicide attempt survivors who said that when they were in their moment of crisis, when they were thinking about going to the place where they were planning on killing themselves, what they really needed to do was get in touch with someone who was their kind of foundation to life. Who did they want to talk to when they were in this moment of crisis? And they said, if we had some kind of an app that let us kind of get to our three key people really quickly so we don't have to sift through the bajillion people that are on our contact list, that would help me so much, because when they're in crisis, they are focused. They they are tunnel visioned. So they wanted something that was easy to download, easy to get through, easy to use, not a lot of pictures, not a lot of text, but could connect them to their support network quickly and easily. So we developed the My3 Suicide Prevention mobile app. I'm just going to kind of brief through some of the features here. Here's the main homepage that you'll always get when you pull up the app, and under the Add Contacts page, you can just kind of click through and add the contacts that you want to add in. It comes preloaded with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is the 24/7 lifeline that anyone can call anywhere in the world to get support, and then also 911 in case they've already self-harmed. We culled some kind of key resources throughout the country and kind of subdivided them by topic. So if you are a veteran who's interested in LGBTQ issues, you can kind of upload the Veterans Hotline to your resources page or the Trevor Project's hotline, which is specifically for LGBTQ youth. This feature, the safety plan, who here is familiar with the idea of safety planning? All right. Usually when I speak in more mental health circles, they're more familiar with safety planning. Maybe public health circles, not so much. But safety planning is this tiered plan that someone can follow. They make it themselves. They make it with a provider, whether it's a mental health care provider. It's a tiered plan that someone can follow on their own to do self-care. So first you kind of list, okay, what are my warning signs? What are the things that trigger my thoughts of suicide? What are my coping strategies? What are my distractions? What are the things that, okay, if my coping strategies aren't helping, where can I just go to get away from my thoughts? What's my network? Who do I need to call? My friends, my mental health provider, my local crisis line? Who are these people that I need to be in touch with quickly? Keeping myself safe, what are some of the access to lethal means that I should stay away from? And one thing that's not reflected here but is in the app is this line that people can fill out that basically says, my reason for living is. And that's just kind of that foundational statement that people can read. And again, in that tunnel vision period of time when people are in crisis, this really grounds them to life. It follows a safety plan that was developed in Columbia University by Barbara Stanley and Gregory Brown, has been used across various different mental health service providers as well as crisis lines throughout the country. So if you have any questions about that, that's at my3app.org. And again, we have some materials out here that you can check out. And then finally, the last thing I wanted to touch on was the framework for standardized data collection across crisis centers. So if you guys have ever... So if you guys have ever worked with crisis centers, what's really interesting is that they all collect data in various ways. They might have different age categories that they capture. They might have different metrics for what it means to be at risk for suicide or maybe not as high risk. So in California, we really wanted to understand, okay, we have so many crisis centers in California. Clearly people are using them. We need to know who is using the crisis centers or in the crisis hotline services, and where are the gaps? Who's not calling that should be calling? Because this is really a way for us to inform our outreach efforts. So there's really not much to say about here, but we did develop, we started with a pilot project of 10 crisis centers throughout California. They worked for about a year and a half, if not more, to develop this training manual for what we are calling common metrics. So these 10 crisis centers, they all changed and tweaked their data collection processes so that they could really gather data, kind of standardized data across all the crisis centers. And I don't think I have the actual metrics, but there were 6 modules that they collected on, which was risk, age, demographics, and a couple other things. And one of the nice things was that they do check for how suicidal you feel when you call in, and then how suicidal do you feel after the call is done. And across the board, you see a dramatic decrease in suicidality among the callers. So we are expanding this project to include the rest of the crisis centers throughout California. And I just think it's really exciting because I know many states do have at least 2 or 3 crisis centers in their state that could really benefit from not only capturing the standardized data, but it really is also another way for crisis centers to work with each other and in collaboration with each other, which we have only seen good things come out of that collaboration. So I think that's it for me, and I'm going to hand it off to Anne.
as you can see, some of the synergy between the different initiatives, and now we will have our student mental health initiative. Ann Collentine is our program manager for Cal Mesa, has been with us for about 5 years, has a long history in health administration and in teaching in the state of California, and has been a real valuable asset to us as far as organizing the various efforts of all these initiatives and the different projects. They have over 25 different contracts with all the from social marketing to University of California and everything in between. And she's been focused on the student mental health initiative.
Wow. Good afternoon. Have we kept you awake? It's a little overwhelming. We are only giving you a real quick snapshot of the gazillion things that we have been able to do in California with a really large amount of money that we think is so unusual that we were excited to come here today and say to you, and I hope that you walk away with this in your folder, we want to share these. We want to share these practices. We want to share these tools. We want to share our learnings with all of you who are from other states who may not have had the resources to develop these types of activities, but certainly could pick up on these activities and replicate them and adapt them to your state, your community, wherever you are working. We think that these are tools that are not just for us to hold on to in California. We are well about trying to turn the curve in all of these areas, not just in California. And just to make a quick statement about that, our initial plan was a 3-year plan, and our board of directors of the Joint Powers Authority recently adopted a continuation of the projects that really reformulates them in a public health model that says we want to turn the curve in California. We want to make a long-term investment in prevention in these areas in California. So please, we hope these resources are useful to you. And if you walk away today with one resource that you can use in your community, we will have felt it was very worthwhile to be here today. So with that being said, I'm going to talk about our last initiative, which is the Student Mental Health Initiative. So in the Student Mental Health Initiative, we have, as Dr. Clark has said, we have 25 contracts across the three initiatives. And in student mental health, we have contracts with our three public higher education systems, our community colleges, our universities, and our state universities. So in total, that represents more than about 175 public campuses in higher education in California. We also have a contract with the State Superintendent's Educational Support Services Association, which represents all of the school districts and county offices of education in California, which you can imagine in a state of 39 million people, how many school districts and how many counties that is. In California, our local governance is a county. We have 58 counties in California, and many of those have multiple school districts. So the County Office of Education becomes the unifier, and we have a contract to disseminate to all of those. So in student mental health, our goal is to improve student mental health, to increase access to appropriate mental health services, and to decrease negative mental health related to school outcomes, such as school dropout, or improve student attendance. As a former teacher, all of this is very close to my heart. How are we doing this? We are doing this by training school staff and faculty on how to respond to students with mental health concerns and equip them with relevant resources. We are increasing the capacity of school systems to implement best practices. We are changing school policies in mental health and suicide prevention in schools, and we are promoting collaboration between systems. When we look at these three initiatives, student mental health, suicide prevention, and stigma and discrimination reduction, we really see the stigma reduction as being the centerpiece of these pieces. We look at suicide prevention as being a critical public health concern for everyone, and we look at student mental health as being an infrastructure to disseminate all of this messaging because people work in schools, pre-K all the way through higher education. So we've developed all of these resources you've just heard about, which the model works really well because we get to disseminate that through our contracts with higher education as well as pre-K and K-12. And so in addition, we have created specific resources that for our student mental health initiative, which I will go over today. These are listed here, but I'll just be going over them. So first we're going to talk a little bit about our K-12 Mental Health Resource Clearinghouse. This was set up by our mental health partner, K-12. It's a clearinghouse that lists resources available for teachers, faculty, families, everything. They can go to this clearinghouse. The beauty of this clearinghouse is, once again, the infrastructure being through our county offices of education who have relationships with school districts, that this information actually gets out to schools through trainings and they have this resource to go back to. We track Google Analytics on this site. We've seen in the last 3 years probably this site, the site is now averaging about 9,000 individuals accessing it, specifically unique visitors looking for information every year, and the number is increasing every year as the information goes out. And we're continuing to add resources to this site. Number one site that people are looking, resource that they're looking for, because you can actually do a search, is anger management. Find that interesting. You pick up little tidbits that are just kind of fun. As a former teacher, it's like, oh yeah, anger management, I get it. I'm not sure if it's the teachers or it's the students or the faculty or dealing with bureaucracy, one of the above. So those are some of the things that are on the site. We're constantly adding new things, all of them being evidence-based practices. And again, as we develop resources, all of those get posted to this site. Tools and resources that we're developing under the SP and SDR campaigns, we're also using and disseminating through this site. So, higher education. We've done a ton with higher education as well. As I said, it's probably unique in California that we've been able to contract with the three public higher education systems in California. And as a result, we are able to reach all systems, and part of working together is quarterly those three systems meet together and we collaborate within those three systems to share resources. And this is an example of the success of one of those. University of California campuses came up with something called the Red Folder that they had used on two of their campuses. It's now disseminated on all 10 of their campuses. It's a simple folder. It's given to every faculty and staff member at the beginning of the school year. In this, it tells them, say something, see something, do something. It tells them how to respond to a student who they might perceive has needs or they're perceiving something just doesn't feel right. It does not say you are the professional who is supposed to be doing this. It tells you how to refer this person. Emphasis on how to refer this person and how to warmly refer this person. In addition, each campus has a unique set of resources that are unique to that campus. This was done on all of the UC campuses. It is now being replicated in all 23 of the CSU campuses, which means distribution to 45,000 staff and faculty on the CSU campuses in California. We're working to find funding to get this available for the 112 community college campuses in California. I have given this to friends who teach in other states who go, I want this. I have been contacted by other states who say, we need this. We know that 1 out of 5 of our students in higher education has a need in terms of behavioral services that will help them succeed in school. We have found this through our RAND study. Recently in the spring, there was an incident on our UC Santa Barbara campus where a number of students were killed. It was very tragic, and it was a huge response and had huge impact on the UC Santa Barbara campus. And as a result of the Red Folder and the collaboration of this initiative, counselors who came from other UC campuses to help triage with staff and faculty on that, when they came to the campus and they saw the Red Folder, they knew exactly what it was for and how to use it and how to help those students. Oh, I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but, the other piece I just wanted to add is, they are also creating public service announcements created by students that are being used on all of those campuses, created on those campuses, things around gatekeepers training, bystander training, veteran awareness, All of those are available on our website if it's something you want to download and use in your community. In addition, we have an interactive screening tool that is being used on all of our UC campuses that has resulted in 80,000 students being screened on our UC campuses for depression. So when I say there's some synergy between all of these initiatives, there is. We use Cognito as an online suicide prevention tool on all 112 of our community college campuses. We were able to find that in looking, RAND as our evaluator did an online anonymous survey of almost 40,000 students and 15,000 faculty and staff. And we found differences between our three systems, but when we look, we are trying to ground our work in baseline so that we can see over the course of this public health model, what kind of changes are we making over time? What is effective? What is not effective? How do we quality improve along the way? And one of the things that we discovered here is we see that the percent of students with probable psychological distress is 19% across all of our campuses. And the ranges are very different across our campuses. What this doesn't tell you is the amount of resources on each one of those systems and their ability to respond to a student in need. So then we have the Educator's Guide to Children's Mental Health in California. We don't think we have to reinvent the wheel, but sometimes we have to adapt something so that it's useful in California. The Educator's Guide, the Student Mental Health and Wellness Guide in California, is specifically adapting a resource that has been used and developed out of Minnesota, and we're making it adapted to California so we can name resources and laws and specific information in California, so all of our educators in California would have this resource available. Now, this is a hard resource. It doesn't come in electronics. Sometimes, I'm a former teacher, so I understand. Sometimes I literally want to have a spiral-bound notebook that sits there as a resource. Sometimes I'm not going to want to look something up on the internet. I don't have the time. I don't have the patience. All I can say is get me that resource. It can sit in my desk drawer, or it can sit in my briefcase, and I know that I can pull it out if I need to have information, and I know it's factual information, and I don't need to spend time loading up my computer and all of that. So if you're an educator, you know what I'm talking about. With our community colleges, we found that we had a wonderful independent living program that was geared towards foster youth that were attending our community colleges. But there was a huge gap. There wasn't a social and emotional well-being module within that curriculum for our transition age foster youth, who we knew would oftentimes have social and emotional situations that they needed to adapt to. So we created a module that's being used in this curriculum in California. I say that, it's available to all of you. So those are the types of things I want you to be aware of, sitting in other states, working with youth and families, understanding that these resources are available and adaptable to you and your state or your community. The last two, it's almost like you keep the best for last, and I only say that because Stephanie, it was really painful for her to give this up to my part of the presentation, but in the stigma and discrimination reduction campaign, it's new turf. What we're doing in California is very, very groundbreaking, and there is a ton of resources, and I did not want this one to be missed because it's special. Not that the others aren't, but I really want you to see it and see it in context. Walk in Our Shoes is available in English and Spanish. It's geared for 9 to 13-year-olds, 4th through 6th graders, well, 4th through 8th graders, actually, but I've seen performances with 4th through 6th graders where there's a performance, there's a website, and there's media that goes along with it. What we've done in the last 2 years is we've done this performance in grade schools and middle schools throughout California. Last year we presented to about 18,000 students in California. This fall we're just finishing up a tour of about 20,000 students in California. As a result of the initial tour, students are eating it up. I guess that's really what I could say, is eating it up. I've observed the performance. It's fantastic. It's about 20 minutes. We've got a bunch of squirrely little 4th through 6th graders who do not move, who hardly breathe. They are so captivated to see young people talking about bullying, talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, talking about ADHD, talking about their lives, their stress, their what they feel in a way that is approachable to them by young performers who come in and in a very quick 20 minutes cover a vast array of very important information that somehow seems to have hit that sweet spot with young people where they do not move, and then afterwards it goes to a question and answer session, and the kids are just off the, they just want to talk. Teachers, we've had more testimonials come in from teachers and faculty even a year later saying, can you bring that performance back a year later? My kids are still talking about it a year later. I'm a teacher. I know that that's pretty different. I just want to say we're really excited. It comes with a teacher's curriculum. It's accompanied by staff who are there to answer questions, to work with students. If a student were to raise an immediate issue for a student, we have trained professional school staff that are there as part of the performance. But we have young people that are answering the questions. Exciting. Available to you. Right now, I think we have a waiting list of over 200 schools wanting to get into those performances. This is, again, we have 45,000 students. You go to the website, even if you can't see the performance, go to the website, build a shoe. You'll understand why it's so exciting. We do have a videotape of the performance, which would be available with the curriculum if it was something that you wanted to replicate and do in your community. And we have found through post-evaluation a significant increase in the knowledge and shift in attitudes of those who have watched the performance. Then we have another program which is called Directing Change. Directing Change is geared towards high school and the university students were so excited about it. UC adapted it to the UC in our second year. The first year we had approximately 300 schools participate. The second year more than 400, representing more than 2,000 students. The students create a one-minute PSA. They're sponsored by a faculty member, and it's either on suicide prevention or stigma and discrimination reduction. They submit that to the contest. There's a prize for winning. We have, as Wayne called it, an Academy Performance or an Oscar Academy Awards performance thing in Sacramento where we have a local movie theater, historic movie theater. It's seen on the big screen. They are amazing to watch. The young people dress up. They get an award. We actually are able to, a director comes up from Hollywood. He was so excited about it. He comes up, donates his time, hands out the awards, talks about it. And then the students, while they're up there, they go over to the Capitol, which is a block from where the theater is, and they actually meet with their local legislators and do education. We don't call it advocacy, but we do education. And what else happens is those students, oftentimes those local legislators, will write a resolution recognizing the school and the student for participating in this contest. So it creates this wonderful synergy. We've got suicide prevention, we've got stigma and discrimination reduction, and we have student mental health all working to turn the curve and build mental health awareness in California in prevention and promotion. It's a win-win-win. We're very excited about it. Then, following that, the schools are provided by NAMI a ending the silence presentation to the school and a suicide prevention program to the school by the Know the Signs staff. So again, it's education and it's integrating the three initiatives disseminating through the school systems. One piece that I didn't mention in all of this that I feel is a disservice not to mention in terms of understanding partnerships. We are a statewide initiative. Our board is made up of local county behavioral health directors. They are the body that watches and oversees our work to make sure the implementation is good and to make sure it enhances and builds on the local investment in prevention and early intervention activities going on already in California. So we don't just come and willy-nilly do this. We build it integrating into what's going on locally as best we can, wherever we can. So again, I offer these all to you as a resource. And Dr. Clark is going to finish up and talk about some of the evaluation resources that are available to you. There will be time for questions, and I also do want to say, in your folders we provided a copy of the PowerPoint as well as some information about our programs, and we have swag, which is really unusual. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. As you can see, we've been given a gift to work on all these projects over the last several years, and we have a lot of products that we give to you to use in your communities, wherever you may be going to. Fortunately, we also had an opportunity to have the RAND Corporation evaluate and continue to evaluate. It's a multi-phase evaluation of individual programs, their collective impact, improving student mental health, reducing suicides, and reducing stigma and discrimination. We wanted to do baseline kind of community indicators, so they've done surveys with that. They've done them in the universities and the schools. They've done thorough program evaluations. We've identified innovative programs for replication. We've steered the ship. It's been a continuous quality improvement, so the feedback has helped us, and it's really been a benefit, and we have numerous publications and out of RAND. So you can go to the website I'll give you in a few minutes, and there'll be sometimes 2 pages, 3 pages, sometimes 20 pages, evaluation studies on various aspects of the projects we have. Some of the baseline findings, stigma discrimination reduction and suicide prevention statewide survey results for young adults we have, a student mental health higher education campus-wide survey, very informative about what student and faculty knowledge and attitudes about stigma and suicide is and how we're going to try to change that. And so those baseline indicators are very important. Also, racial and ethnic differences across stigma as well as suicide give you some good indication. I had a researcher at an earlier panel asking about Asian Pacific Islanders, and we have some specifics about that that are some good research findings for folks to take a look. There's the website that you can get that, and again, it's in your folder. One of the things I learned early on is that when you're doing evaluation, you're not just dealing with outcomes, you're also dealing with reach. And that's how many people actually touch or see or get the kind of information that you're disseminating. So we've directly and trained, educated 195,000 people. We've directly reached 1,235,000. We've reached through informational resources 10 million. And we've media impressions or views. And this is contacts. This is not, we don't have 786 million people in California at this point in time, although it's growing, but that'd be 20 years or so. But at least it gives you an idea that the campaign is reaching and it's getting some traction with people throughout the country and throughout California. Again, all statewide PEI evaluations or publications to date are on the RAND Corporation. Policy impacts. One of the things that we did early on is recognize that you're not just doing training, you're not just doing social marketing, you also want to try to impact policies. I had an opportunity to work with Stan Glantz in the smoking cessation efforts early on, and his theme of think globally, act locally, and he was always, we couldn't impact the federal government because of the lobbying in Washington. But we could impact the city councils and places in our communities, and we could do that parks by parks, restaurants by restaurants, government centers by government centers. And I think we can do some of the similar kind of changes in changing the social norms about mental health and mental illness in our society. And so we funded some of the policy issues. We looked at Disability Rights California, the crisis intervention teams that exist in California. There's a variety of them. I just was at a conference with the California Highway Patrol. They took that policy initiative, introduced it to several legislators. They're going to potentially have a statewide crisis intervention team advocacy and training in the state of California for all first responders, including fire, dispatch, and others, so that you have an opportunity to de-escalate things out in the streets rather than have be the kind of unfortunate situations we've had in other communities, our own as well. The Associated Press guidelines that our colleagues put together so that the Associated Press now talks about mental illness and mental health in different ways than they have before, so that they really get guidelines for that and impacting how the press deals with things. Anne worked very vigorously on a K-12 teacher and administrating credentialing standards. Every 10 years, they change the credentialing standards in California. She got us so that we can have, for the next 10 years, mental health as one of the components in the teacher credentialing and education and administrative in the state of California for all teachers and educators. Common metrics of suicide prevention. We had all these different suicide prevention lines. We wanted to consolidate and make that so that we can all look the same across the state. Research tools for underserved ethnic populations. It's just been a really nice thing to have the opportunity to impact policy as well as to all the social marketing and the green bands and ribbons that we have. So what we wanted to do at this time is just to open it up. I do have to make a plug, or I would get my green ribbon around my neck, I think. The 7th International Conference, we're working with the Worldwide Psychiatric Association to have a conference that's in San Francisco, February 17th through the 20th. And it's going to have worldwide. We've been talking to people in the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia about some of the things they're doing, the third world underdeveloped nations as well, about things they're doing in stigma and how that can really create a national, international movement to reduce stigma in our societies. And so there's a registration for that, and that's we're co-sponsoring it, but it's the World Psychiatric Association. So questions, and for any one of the panels, and go ahead, I know you've been waiting.
Just a theme that goes through a lot of this, and I'll just say that I'm a mental health professional, a licensed community social worker who's worked at the VA hospital, worked in private hospitals, you know, in different populations. And even last slide, you know, in terms of the mentioned Rand Corporation, breakdown of data, talk about underserved communities, right? Breakdown ethnic, racial, cultural. I don't see gender. And gender, we know, particularly in terms of suicide or mental health treatment, those of us in the mental health field know, percentage of people who come for mental health treatment are overwhelmingly female. And in terms of the percentage of people who kill themselves, probably across all age groups, are primarily males. So the question is, are you segmenting, like, using these different charts and looking at, you know, the information that's getting out? Is there a breakdown over and above racial and ethnic of gender? Because I imagine that's going to be a very, very critical piece, and it's very interesting how it's sort of like, it just like doesn't make the radar screen, and that's very interesting to me, and I'm actually part of a foundation for male studies in the presentation era, and we are basically involved in raising the consciousness on a number of issues about the role of gender based on findings in terms of differences in even the brains of males and females. So it's just so much that also needs to be kind of thrown.
I think you could, with the research that Rand's doing, we can really drill down and see the difference between male and female as far as the research analytics. As far as the policies behind that, that's where you need to connect research and policy, and I think that's what you're addressing.
So you are can break these down.
Absolutely. And that's why, and I wasn't kidding or being facetious by any means. We have a serious problem with our reach out program. We do look at gender, we look at age very specifically, and the people who use the reach out online chat, that style of support is really predominantly female. And so we really redirected resources, and we'll be doing a program this year that really targeted urban males under the age of 24 through basically like an R&B hip-hop program. I don't know. I guess my point is that you do bring up a really good issue that I think we do need to be more cognizant of, and to make sure that we're also really looking at those differences and having a commitment to doing things differently for those populations.
Do you want to put up a possible idea? Even the term reach out, generally, women and females reach out more than men do.
maybe for males, if you change it to call it something else that sounds a little cooler, because even that term might be something that could be an inhibitor to males doing.
Good point. Yes.
I'd like to know more about the process of the development of the social marketing plan itself, and how you included families and youth in the development of the social marketing plan to get to all of these things.
Let me start with the stigma reduction. If we were focusing just on our campaign, we would probably put up more information, but we use what we call our strategic council, and on that council sits a variety of different people, including, the professionals in terms of the child development experts, but also an organization called CIAN, it's the California Youth Empowerment Network, and we really look at them as they're our youth advisors, and they're involved in every decision along the way as we develop the campaign. On the family side, we work primarily with NAMI California. Again, they're part of the Strategic Council. They helped make decisions every step of the way. For the parents, people who are parents of children who are under the age of 18, we have an organization in California called United Advocates for Children and Families, which is close to the Federation of Families, that is a national organization. So for us, it was really important, and I think actually part of our stress is that we had this short timeline, but we took a very long amount of time to really develop the tools and resources because we wanted them to be driven by the people who were going to use them. Because sitting in a room with a bunch of, particularly, and I'm a social worker, and I had to learn to work how to work with marketers, it was a little bit of a challenge for me. I think that they grew a lot by listening to people from the community, listening to people with lived experience, listening to youth, listening to educators, and then really just being an instrument for those voices. So, because they knew, as social marketers, that if they didn't listen to those voices and create materials that were reflective of their voice, that the people who were going to champion them and use them in the community wouldn't be interested in using them. So,
I just want to add one thing. The other piece to that is, I think Stephanie earlier went through and talked about speakers' bureaus. That was also, along the way, part of our quality improvement is hearing from family members, community members, saying, this is all a great social marketing campaign, but how do we make it real for us in our communities? Thus, the Speakers Bureaus, which is a very small grant that is going to community-based organizations, faith groups, schools, PTA. We had a whole array of folks that were recently granted money so that we could improve that campaign and really drill down and get that into the community in a unique and different way based on what we had had as early findings. I don't know if that answered, but... The question was with all of the information and referrals in the higher education system, have the counseling and psychological services, CAPS, been able to meet the increased demand for services? No, they have not. And so what they have done is two things. One is those campuses have invested a ton in gatekeeper training. They're working through the Greek populations. They're working through student health educators on campuses. They've really engaged in peer-to-peer support on those campuses. That's not to replace the professionally trained individuals. However, they're all using it with each one of their systems to advocate for more funding because they were already seeing this huge spike going on. And so what they've been able to do through these resources is really gather the data that has given them the ability to make the ask. And they are currently, they're all making that ask.
And a question over here?
I was just wondering, too, community-wise, I would think there would be an expansion of need of resources as well. People are calling the crisis centers. Where are the crisis centers referring these individuals to? are families feeling like the services are not available that they need to help with the mental health services for their children or loved ones?
Well, I'll handle that a couple of different ways. And the question is, what has this in the community seen an increased demand for mental health services in the communities? And I think we've seen that nationwide. And I attribute some of that to Sandy Hook. I think that the awareness of mental health and social isolation is such that people are starting to say, this person needs help. There needs to be more assistance. Again, fortunately in California, we have Senator Steinberg, and he came up with $120 million for additional crisis residential, mobile crisis, and crisis stabilization units in the state. They're not built yet, or they're in the process of being built, but we already are working in our community, I know, on mobile crisis teams, working with our law enforcement. They're very thankful. They want to decrease the number of folks that go into the emergency rooms that have crisis situations and de-escalate those and keep people in the community. And so that's some of what needs to be done, but the politicians have to invest, and there has to be a champion that pushes that to make sure that there's an investment. Because without that, you know, mental health is a very small percentage of the healthcare dollar. You know, the American Public Health Association is huge. The mental health section is pretty small. You know, so go ahead.
So maybe the solution is getting the corporations who, you know, kind of fund the politicians anyway to exert, you know, to kind of put their little influence in there, so they can work on the corporate level and have politicians.
But we've been talking to our colleagues in Canada who have been working with their private corporations about workplace issues because of the problems they've had. They're specifically working right now with the Mounted Police up in Calgary, but they're also working with corporations in because they want to have a better mental health workplace. And somebody this morning was saying that there was a study done, if you have good mental health in the workplace versus those that don't, they're doing better on the stock exchange. I think it was Ron Mandershot saying that. Yes.
Great question. Love the question, I just say. We're not able to do it throughout. I do know in Orange County, our program has been able to fund mindfulness curriculum, mindfulness training for teachers and educators in Orange County, and they're actually able to take that to other communities of California, and it is about the mindfulness curriculum and really creating a stronger movement towards that mindfulness piece. It's growing.
And we could work with you on connecting to what they're doing in Orange County, so in the Bay Area we can also be doing that. Yes?
Give me your card. One of the things I know that they're also doing in Orange County is California just recently restructured how it does school financing. And so one of the indicators of school local accountability plans is school climate. So in Orange County, they've actually developed a whole survey and a whole way of looking at school climate. So I imagine I have not looked at the details, but they've probably done something to match that with Orange County school climate stuff.
Yeah, one of the things that we did in Monterey County is we went to the superintendent and said, you give us 50 cents, we'll make a dollar out of it. And so they put 18 additional therapists in the schools that work for us and then are in the schools. And mindfulness certainly could be one of the things that we train our staff to do. They're also very interested in positive behavioral intervention, the changes of the culture of the school, and that's another way of also getting into some of the work with the mindfulness. So, and one of the ways PBIS has been very successful is to get their research out in front and show the schools that it saves money, increases it average daily attendance, and school participation, expulsions go down, graduations go up. That kind of research is very helpful for policy. Yes?
We've sponsored peer-to-peer conferences where students actually, I went to the one last year which had probably 600 to 800 students across the state who are all peer educators meeting to share resources. What a wonderful experience, a gift in my life to be around young people sharing what they're doing on their campuses and sharing those resources and building those leadership. So we are seeing that on all of our campus systems. Less so at the community colleges, simply because the UC system and the CSU system are a chancellor system. They have one chancellor for the state of California. Our community colleges are like school districts. They have districts. So it's been very different, our impact working across the community colleges. They're less resourced and they're less standardized through that chancellor's piece. But we do know that we are working at both the CSU and the UC system, and we're bringing in community colleges as best we can to those resources to build that leadership. And recently down in UC Riverside, they just had a health educators leadership forum as well.
Yes.
The question about measuring outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious about, I keep on asking, like, what are modifiable outcomes that we can measure to show that mental health promotion works in schools? A few years ago, I have worked in the public school system in the city of Birmingham, and the research gatekeeper person at the central office told me that they aren't interested in mental health. Mental health doesn't matter. If I can see it in A, B, C, D, the student grade, that's what we want. So,
let me take it. First of all, the issue of outcomes is a challenge for mental health in general, to make sure that we can get measurable outcomes on a regular basis for the interventions that occur. In prevention, it's even a little more difficult. It doesn't. However, by doing things like baseline studies and getting what the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs are at time one and looking at it at time two, you can really then start to see how emotional well-being is changing over time. Regarding the what we found with the PBIS with the schools is that we were able to show that average daily attendance goes up. That's dollars for the school districts. Expulsions go down. That's dollars for the school districts. Graduation rates go up. That's dollars for the school districts, et cetera. So, teachers not calling in sick because the classes are places they want to go to instead of want to stay away from, those go down. So those kind of outcomes really have an impact on changing superintendents and school districts' policies on education. So that's that kind of outcomes are important. Yes? It's Man Therapy. It's out of Colorado, and it's take a look at it. It's controversial because it takes a different approach than what's generally there. It's more for reaching men that don't otherwise listen to people about their issues or feelings. And so it.
And then I have a question about reducing stigma of mental illness and issues without reducing the stigma of actually suicidal behavior.
Well, I mean, I can try to answer it, but I probably won't answer it as eloquently as Teresa. But the idea is that, you know, some people aren't going to be in a place where they can help themselves, but they are surrounded by people who love them, who are going to, if they know the signs, if they, you know, exactly what our campaign kind of teaches people, if they know the signs, if they can find the words, and they're not afraid of confronting someone who they think has those signs, and then they really do know where to go to seek help. And I think we're learning a lot in this campaign, particularly with young people. And it was talked about a little bit, if anyone was in some of the mental health section programs this morning, that need to literally take your college roommate's hand and sit with them all the way through their assessment at the student counseling center is what's really needed, not just, hey, you should call that number that I saw in the bathroom. It really is working with our young people and, you know, working with other people in the community to have them really care for another community member and go through that process so that they are not alone in what they're experiencing is kind of a scary situation. So I don't know if that particularly answers your question, but...
Let me also add, when we were doing the stakeholder, we had two types of suicide survivors. We had the individuals and their families. And their families were very profound in what they would have liked to have known or liked to have done. And so that influenced some of our policy with that as well, so that they can learn how to help. And Teresa, I don't know what you want to say.
Yeah, just a couple of... Who can ask the question? I'm sorry, I just spent about the time. One other thing, kind of a practical nature of focusing on helpers, was one of the things that the campaign had to do was reach all Californians, which, oh my God, is a huge undertaking. So focusing on the helpers was really one way to capture... Really, there's people who are experiencing thoughts of suicide. They're few and far between. So really reaching out to helpers and really going into a place where maybe helpers really hadn't been spoken like that before was really a new arena for the campaign. But then another thing to also consider is we also increased the capacity of local crisis lines to also do their marketing as well. So the crisis lines across California have increased their call volume like a lot. And a lot of that was because we also gave them some capacity to do marketing of their own hotlines, and there was a lot of cross collaboration, so there'd be like the Science logo on their marketing material. So they were doing their outreach to people at risk. We were doing the outreach to the helpers, and kind of that synergy again of both of those marketing efforts really raised awareness across all different populations.
Are you seeing more calls from family members to crisis line?
I don't know the data specifically, but I do know that all the crisis lines are seeing like at least 120% increase in calls since we helped them kind of beef up their efforts. But yes, we do see a lot of people calling to help someone else.
Thank you, folks, for staying with us. Appreciate it.